Answering Mormons Questions by Bill McKeever and Eric Johnson deals with 36 commonly asked questions by your LDS friends and neighbors. It's a great resource for Christians who want to share their faith with friends and loved ones. Be sure to pick up your copy today at your favorite Christian bookstore. Viewpoint on Mormonism, the program that examines the teachings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints from a biblical perspective. Viewpoint on Mormonism is sponsored by Mormonism Research Ministry. Since 1979, Mormonism Research Ministry has been dedicated to equipping the body of Christ with answers regarding the Christian faith in a manner that expresses gentleness and respect. And now, your host for today's Viewpoint on Mormonism.
One of the most foundational beliefs of the LDS Church is the Great Apostasy. The Church claims that the keys of the priesthood conferred on the first apostles by Jesus were lost from the earth sometime shortly after they died. This means that for many centuries, there was no priesthood authority on earth to exercise and pass along the most important aspects of the Christian faith. Mormons believe that that authority was finally restored upon this earth by God through a young Joseph Smith in the early 1800s. The LDS Church, then, is considered to be a restoration of the things lost during that period. So the Great Apostasy is an essential belief in Mormonism, because there would be no justification for a restoration of anything that wasn't lost in the first place. But the simple truth is, there was no Great Apostasy.
The voice you just heard was Rich Sanford, one of the producers of a number of videos that can be found at godlovesmormons.com. The Great Apostasy, that's what we're going to talk about today. Welcome to this edition of Viewpoint on Mormonism. I'm your host, Bill McKeever, founder and director of Mormonism Research Ministry. And with me today is Eric Johnson, my colleague at MRM. But we also have Rich Sanford and Bradley Campbell, the two men that have put together a number of excellent videos dealing with the theology and history of the LDS Church. Today, a historical subject, and that is this Great Apostasy, because if there was no Great Apostasy, according to the context of Mormonism, there would be no need for the Mormon Church to exist. This, as I mentioned, is one of many videos that you have put together, and I wish we could go through all of them. There's dozens of them out there, and we really want to bring attention to what you have put together, because they are very, very good, very well done videos. But the Great Apostasy, talk about that.
This is one of those things that I think is such a bottleneck for Mormonism. You just said it right there. There's an assumption, oftentimes when we're talking with people on the street, that we must be in agreement that for 1,400 plus years of Christian history, everything was underwater, that all authority was gone, that there was no true church in here. I'm amazed at how often that a Mormon assumes that I, as an evangelical Christian, think that. And so I oftentimes, when I realize in a conversation that a person is introducing or at least drawing upon that assumption, I go, hold on, you know that the Bible would teach us that there would be no great apostasy. And oftentimes, the first response is shock. They never heard of somebody introduce that for them. And I try to trace it back to that, because there would be no justification for a restoration of the gospel, but just as you said, if there was no great apostasy. And I'll oftentimes introduce that topic by saying first, you know that we do not believe that there ever was a great apostasy. In fact, Jesus made it clear that the Christians in the Bible should never expect a great apostasy. And usually I'll bring them to Matthew 13. That's the place that I'll go to the kingdom building parables.
When talking with someone, demonstrate the attitude Jesus had towards the church that he was establishing. People are often shocked to see when you just read through some of the parables in Matthew 13. I just walk through, Bible open, verse by verse. Look at what Jesus said. He seemed to say that, you know, this small mustard seed is going to grow and grow and grow. It's not going to grow for, a couple decades and then die and then stay dead for hundreds of years and then start over again. Jesus is expecting a consistent growth of this mustard seed and the wheat and the tares and the leaven that, you know, makes its way through all of it. And so, yeah, I think when you demonstrate that to a person, they're like, oh.
So this is one of those times where I literally do is open my Bible to Matthew 13. I might start in Matthew 16 and read through the establishment of the church, and I usually don't even get caught up into what is the rock. Is the rock Peter? Is the rock the gospel? Or is the rock Revelation? I usually just kind of let that one go for that moment. And I say, okay, irrespective of what the rock was upon which Jesus is going to build his church, who builds the church? And in every version, no matter what their view, their hold is about what that rock is, it's Jesus says, I will build my church. And there will never be any problems. No, he says, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. The point of Jesus' introduction here is that as the church comes into being, his expectation is there's going to be great controversy. There's going to be a great conflict for the church. And yet, in the greatest face of conflict, it's not going to fail. It will do what it's supposed to do. It will succeed. And on that, I'll usually go to Matthew 13. And I'll read those verses out loud. And I'll show the wheat and the tares. And how both the wheat and the weeds or the tares grow together. And the master who owns the field says, don't pull out the tares yet. Let them both grow together till the end. And then we will reap a harvest. And at that point, there will be a distinguishing between those two parts. And leaven and the bread. It's gonna be working even when you don't see it.
I think one of the great excuses of this whole great apostasy theory is the Mormon people don't feel like they are obligated to explain to us why there is such a difference between what they believe in their basic doctrines and what early Christians had always believed. The point that I'm trying to make here is they will often insist that theirs is a restoration, but yet when you look at what they believe, we can't find anywhere in the early Christian church that any of those things were ever taught or believed. Right. And how can you have a restoration if you can't find some kind of a pedigree that supports that needing to be brought back?
Right.
Do you ever find yourself getting into that conversation with Latter-day Saints?
I think it's usually an assumption. That's the expectation. In fact, we sometimes get into parts of the history. Like, why do you think historically that happened? Like, what historical data points do you have for that? And again, most of our conversations are street level with people. We're talking to people who may not have thought through all this stuff a whole lot before. But I'll sometimes even ask, who told you? Where did you learn that all Christianity was in a great apostasy? Where did you learn that? And they inevitably say, well, my Mormon family or bishop or something. Well, that's because they're motivated to tell you that there was a need for the Mormon church. Mm-hmm. But that's not the way. Even Protestants in the great Protestant Reformation did not go, the church is gone, no authority left, we have to restore what's not there. Their thinking was a correction, a reformation on what was already present. They came out of the Catholic Church and sought to hold true to doctrine even up till death. That's the history of Christianity.
How do you guys feel about church history and the knowledge of that to be able to help support the idea there was no great apostasy? And what I mean by that, for instance, is when you ask somebody, what do you say is the mark of the apostasy? And they'll oftentimes mention Constantine and the Council of Nicaea, absolutely, which took place in 325.
Right.
But I always like to ask them, what do they know about that? And they'll come up with all kinds of things. How do you deal with the church history part?
Personally, most of the time on a street level conversation, I will encourage them to investigate that. I will say, I don't think that your thinking about that is correct, especially with the Council of Nicaea. That comes up a ton with questions about canonicity and the Bible and preservation of the text and whatnot. And it's just plain not true. I mean, you can go ahead and read what came out of the Council of Nicaea.
You can just Google that.
Very rarely, if I say, you know, I don't think that's correct. Have you ever looked into that? I encourage you to just do a simple Google search when you get home. Just look it up and take an hour and read through some of that. I very rarely have someone push back and say, no, that's not true. It's definitely in there.
Our videos, of course, are like lecture style. We're delivering information and we're not discoursing. We typically do this just through questioning of people. And so I'll try to probe almost immediately what they think. Like, why do you think that? Oh, you heard that from Mormons. Did you ever hear that outside of Mormonism? Has any other non-Mormon told you that? Okay, well, maybe you should consider that. What do you think happened at the Council of Nicaea? Can you name one person who was there? Like, I'll sometimes do that just to kind of test, and they'll sheepishly go, well, no. And I go, okay, well, I think you might not understand what happened there. Just something worth chasing out for yourself. But as relates to the Bible, the believers there expected an age of unprecedented Christian growth in the face of opposition. Those two things are promised. The church is going to grow and it's going to be bad for you. And people will die before they will relent and let go of the gospel. Paul says, let me be accursed if I, an apostle, start preaching another gospel. He commends the church to test things like the Bereans against the word of God. All these references in the New Testament to our being careful about false teachers is that we would have a preservation of the text, that we'd have a preservation of what is true. Paul even writes in 1 Corinthians 11, he's admonishing the church for some of its practices with communion. And he says, I believe there's some division here. I believe it in part. He goes, but there must be factions amongst you so that those who are genuine amongst you might be recognized. Paul already anticipated that there are going to have to be church splits for the preservation of the gospel's sake. And that's what we do, certainly finding church history. This isn't even hard to find. A secular Google can find this out for us.
And I think that illustrates, and this might sound a little bit harsh if we have Latter-day Saints listening today, but I find that many times they are lazy and will not take the time to support what they believe from any type of credible sources other than, as you say, well, I heard it from another Latter-day Saint, or maybe my bishop said this from the pulpit, or maybe I heard something like this in general conference. It's too easy now to find the answers to these. It's too easy to know exactly, for instance, what the Council of Nicaea was all about, what the issues were, who the players were. You're really without excuse nowadays. It's just too easy. But yet we still hear Latter-day Saints giving us these tired old explanations, which you have said, Bradley, are just outright false. So we do need to encourage our LDS friends to look into these. Any last thoughts in this segment?
This is an interesting doctrine for us to talk with Latter-day Saints in conversation, because many have an impulse right now to not judge, especially Christians, but others outside their faith. A lot of younger Mormons feel very uncomfortable about this. And so when we talk about the doctrine of the great apostasy, it's interesting when we point out the fact that the great apostasy is essentially saying that all Christians in the world believe abominable, untrue things about God, so much so that there needed to be a restoration of those things. It is not an inclusion that Mormons are now a part of Christianity and maybe a holier sect, but that we ought not even be called Christians. And when I bring that into the conversation, it often elicits a pretty sheepish response because they realize, yeah, I guess it is pretty judgmental of your views for us to think like this. Sometimes that just kind of helps put the conversation on a different plane, where they're almost feeling apologetic for that. I don't care about the apology. Perhaps it might help soften the mind and the heart to consider that maybe something you guys believe could be valid as well.
I think you raise an excellent point, because oftentimes when we are talking to Latter-day Saints, the very fact that we are questioning what they believe is sometimes misinterpreted as some kind of persecution. We've been talking to Bradley Campbell and Rich Sanford. They are the producers of several videos dealing with the subject of Mormonism, and they can be found at godlovesmormons.com.
Thank you for listening. If you would like more information regarding Mormonism Research Ministry, we encourage you to visit our website at www.mrm.org, where you can request our free newsletter, Mormonism Researched. We hope you will join us again as we look at another viewpoint on Mormonism. Pastor, could your congregation benefit from a presentation that explains the differences between Mormonism and New Testament Christianity? MRM's Bill McKeever and Eric Johnson would be honored to come to your church. Whether it's a single crash course or a weekend symposium, hundreds of churches have benefited from their fully documented and easy-to-understand PowerPoint presentations. If you'd like to schedule MRM at your church, simply write us at contact@mrm.org. Again, that's contact@mrm.org.